Hi, this is Eric Schlein of the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode of the Intelligent Investing Podcast is sponsored by Red Rock Running. Runners and joggers out there, tell me if this sounds familiar. You go into your local running store to pick up some gear, first the shirt, and as you browse the shirts, you see that nice, high-quality performance shirt running you at least $40. Then, you need something to carry your smartphone so you can listen to the Intelligent Investing Podcast while you run. Or maybe you want to track your run with a GPS. A smartphone carrier costs something like $20 or $30. And between work, family, and other responsibilities, the only chance many of us have to go for a run is early in the morning or late at night. That often means running in the dark. So, to help stay safe, you need a reflective vest to increase visibility. That's another $10, $15. So, in total, you can expect to spend over $100 just for gear that goes on your upper body. Red Rock Running has a better way. Their new Bryce running shirt combines all three of those products into one simple item. Secure pockets built directly into each sleeve carry your smartphone or other audio device, a couple of keys, headphones, or energy gels. Strategically placed, reflective material increases your visibility, keeping you safe when running in the dark. Intelligent Investing Podcast listeners know the importance of value. Purchasing a technical shirt, smartphone carrier, and a reflective vest separately costs over $100. The Bryce running shirt, however, gives you all three for only $59. And Red Rock Running is offering listeners this podcast an additional 15% off any purchase by using the promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So that's right, listeners, if you are a listener of the Intelligent Investing Podcast, you get an additional 15% off any purchase of a shirt that's already a good value by using that promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So remember, go to Red Rock Running, REDROCK running.com and receive 15% off your Bryce running shirt with promo code INVESTINGPOD, INVESTINGPOD. Carry more, increase visibility, decrease hassle.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Today we have a guest, Jason Rivera, who runs Rivera Holdings out of Tampa in Florida. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, man. So tell us a little bit about yourself for the listeners at home or in the car or wherever they're listening to podcasts.
Alrighty. My name is Jason Rivera. As Eric said, I'm starting up Rivera Holdings right now. I'm just next week, actually, getting ready to open it to investors.
Congratulations, by the way. That's pretty badass.
Thank you. Looking to raise a $10 million asset base and build my own mini Berkshire Hathaway.
Is that an investor calling right now? Do I have to go?
Oh, no. Twitter, sorry. Okay. I've meant to mute my phone and forgot.
No problem.
I'm a strict and disciplined value investor. I meld my strategies off. I look for three companies that I look to buy into. One is the typical Benjamin Graham NCAV stock, the company selling below net current asset value, ultra conservative valuation, one of the most conservative valuations you can do.
Yeah.
Usually terrible businesses in that range. And then, of course, the Warren Buffett moat competitive advantage type stocks. That's another category I invest in. Most of my investments are actually in that category. I've only got two or three NCAV investments right now. And then another one is a Joel Greenblatt style special situation, value special situation play that I look for. It's companies with hidden assets. Net operating leases, carry forwards, spin-offs, stuff like that, that I look to invest in. I'm invested in one or two of those right now. Let's see.
How'd you get started in all this?
It's funny. I've dealt with severe dizziness issues the most of the last 10 years. Luckily, they're gone now, or for under control with medications for the most part now. But about, let's see, 7 years ago now, I found out my wife was pregnant with our first daughter. And I was like, oh, of course, the new dad thing. My mind, I was just in shock. I mean, I was happy, but I was in shock. And the first thing I started worrying about was, oh, crap, I can't work because of the severe dizziness. So I had to figure out something I wanted to do, or something I eventually could do to make money once my health got better. And I came up with three things that I wanted, or that I thought I could make money at some point. And one was to become a politician, but I didn't figure the world need any more of those. Sorry, Eric.
That's okay. I agree personally.
The next thing was to be a writer, but I remember being told by a high school teacher that, quote, I hope you never want to become a writer because your writing is terrible, or because this paper is terrible. And it was. It was awful at that time. And then third, I took what was called a consumerism class my senior year of high school. And they taught a bunch of things, how to write checks, how to get credit cards, stuff like that, how to establish credit. But one of the things that caught my eye, or that I remember most, was my teacher taught about compound interest. And that's a big value investing concept. Warren Buffett, all these other value investors talk about it nonstop, the power of compound interest. And it was still amazing. I remember the example he gave to this day, and that was, I graduated high school in 2005, so almost 12 years ago now. If you put $2,000 into a bank account or an investment account for 5 years, it's better off over the long term than putting $2,000 after that, because it has more time to compound. And the amount can be staggering. Of course, Buffett's the perfect example of that. He's made, 97% of his $70 billion fortune after the age of 65.
That's insane.
Well, yeah, it's incredible. That's almost by default, that's how I got into value investing, or investing at that point. I just had started learning, but I figured that would be a good way to make money at some point.
So why value investing out of anything else that you could have done in the investment space?
Honestly, I don't remember how I came across the concept of value investing, but yeah. My mom is cheap. She was coupons and stuff when we were kids, and always looking for a deal. Stuff went on sale. So value investing, that's how I was raised. Always look for deals and stuff like that. So it just makes perfect sense to me, buying something that's worth a dollar or more for 50 cents or less. Just makes perfect sense to me. Honestly, trading, it's complete opposite of what, it just doesn't make logical sense to me. After seeing about value investing, I'm a believer in what Warren Buffett and Seth Klarman say about value investing. And I think it's, in some terms, it's probably genetically wired into people. Just as soon as you read about it, it makes perfect sense, or it doesn't.
Isn't that amazing? It's like, this stuff seems like the most common sense stuff in the world. There's just some people that you can explain to them and until you're blue in the face, and they just don't get it.
Yeah, for example, my wife, she likes to spend money more than I do. And I try to explain value investing to her, and she's just like, her eyes just glaze over.
I don't get it. Maybe it's genetic. I don't know. It's kind of weird. Since you're going to be dealing with smaller sums of money, you obviously have a portfolio right now, you said. Are you focusing more on like smaller, more obscure companies, or you kind of have a mix of both? Like, what's your deal around that?
Yeah, I will invest in any company of any size that I can understand, but I like to stick to small, obscure companies.
What's the smallest company in your portfolio right now?
Smallest company in my portfolio right now, and the portfolio as I manage, is, I think, as of now, around $12 million.
Oh, you have me beat there. I think my smallest right now is $18 million.
That's still pretty good. Most value investors are scared to invest in anything under $50 million. Yeah. So.
Well, you know, you're talking to other value investors when you have the smallest company in your portfolio is $18 million market cap, and the guy has you beat with $12 million.
Yeah. Well, the smallest company on my watch list, I think, is like a $4 or $5 million market cap.
Oh, come on, really?
Which just terrifies most people, and it's kind of scary, but it's kind of fascinating to me, because if I'm trying to raise, or I'm looking to raise $10 million, and I'm going to begin presenting to investors next week and querying investors online, and I've been thinking, once I raise $10 million, I could buy two $5 million companies. It's just
right.
Mind-boggling to me.
Would you ever buy privately held companies too, or just public?
Yeah. If I were able to trust the owners, and I met with them and felt like I could trust them, and they gave me good financial information, I would have no problem buying in private companies.
Very cool. And what would you say? I mean, are you typically investing in companies just in the United States, or are you going around the world? What are you doing around that?
This is another area where I'm a bit different from most value investors. Most value investors, or most investors, when they think of investing for themselves or for other people, stick to the United States because it's the biggest market with the most liquidity and everything, and most action.
Do you think that's really true? Maybe you're right. I just never...
About the liquidity and everything?
About sticking to the United States.
Yeah. Actually, when I worked at the investment newsletter, I worked for... in South Florida, they had a ton of analytics that they did on what people wanted to invest in, how much money they have, and stuff like that, and where they preferred. I think it was something over 80% of people said they would prefer to invest only in the United States.
See, this shows how much of an echo chamber I live in.
Yeah, I've always been, I'll invest wherever as long as I can trust that the government won't be seized. For example, like Russia or Venezuela. I won't invest in those countries no matter what at this time, because I don't trust the government. But I was shocked, because I was always pitching these foreign companies at this investment newsletter to recommend, and they kept saying over and over again, our readers won't. They might like what you write, and they might like the recommendation, but most of them will not buy a company overseas.
Interesting.
It's just a home bias that we all have to some degree. It was fascinating to me when I first went down to the investment newsletter, and they kept saying that. On my watch list, I'm invested in, let's see, I think 10 companies right now, and 4 or 5 of them are in the U.S. The rest are overseas. And on my watch list and in the companies I've already bought, there are 22 countries around the world that I've got on my that those companies are based in. I mean, they have operations around the world, but that's where they're based.
Right. Do you use a screener to find these companies, or what are you doing to find ideas?
No, I don't use screeners at all anymore. Since I focus on ROIC, the return on invested capital, ROC, return on capital employed, all these super important metrics, free cash flow to sales margin, all these super important metrics. But when I'm searching for companies, that's not what I look for initially.
So where are you finding these tiny little companies in different countries?
Most of them I find I go to a specific ADR list I can find online. American Depository Receipts, they're foreign listed shares traded in the United States on the United States markets, either on the like New York Stock Exchange or on the over-the-counter markets, the pink sheets. Or as of a couple years ago, this is a project I started. I downloaded the entire OTC markets company database. Mm-hmm. But more than 20,000 companies, and I've been paring that down, going one by one, looking for companies to invest in. I've actually recommended 2 or 3 companies so far by doing that, and another dozen or 2 dozen I have on my watch list from just going one by one through that list.
And are you, when you're sorting through the OTC markets? Are you you'll find a company and then will you go on their website, read their annual reports? What's the process for you around that?
The process for me when I find a company, or since I go one by one, I don't use screeners, so I have to look at each one. I go to Morningstar and I have a preliminary analysis checklist that I use.
Do you have a subscription to Morningstar, or are you just using the free
service? I just use the free Morningstar. Through my library, my local library, I can get on their database, but I don't, at this time, I don't use it. I just go on the free website and pull up my preliminary analysis checklist and go down that. If a company doesn't meet, and this is something I can go through in less than 5 minutes. And most companies like Buffett and all these other value investors say, once you get to a certain amount of knowledge, you can discard a company in 5 seconds if you know what you're doing. So I discard a lot of companies all right off the bat. But once I find a company that looks interesting, I go through this preliminary analysis checklist. And if a company meets enough criteria on there, then I go to the company's website and download their filings and their presentations and then take notes on that. And if the company still meets my criteria that I require, then I'll value it and analyze the company's flow. And then if it still passes that, then I will likely recommend it.
Do you mean their moat?
Or buy it. What was that?
Do you mean analyze their moat?
Their float.
Their float, okay.
Their investment float.
Gotcha. Do you, so when you're looking at these companies, how many of them per 100 would you say even end up going on your watch list?
Going on my watch list?
Yeah.
Probably one out of every 500. Last year I analyzed my data on how many companies I actually invest in. And at that time, it was less than one out of every 500 companies that I look through, I buy.
Okay.
The more, and I'm sure you know this, Eric, as a value investor, the more you know, the stricter your criteria get most of the time. So the fewer companies over time you'll invest in. So now it's probably one out of every 750 companies I research, I invest in on my watch list. It's probably... this is a guess, but it's probably one out of every 300 that go on my watch list.
So what do you look for? What's on your checklist?
On my checklist, I have the if book value's been rising or falling over the past 5 years, the trend on that, the percentage it's risen or fallen, if a company's issued or bought back shares in the last 5 years, because as small, especially focusing on smaller companies, you can't have share dilution. That'll just destroy your entire investment, no matter what the valuation is, if they keep issuing shares over and over again. So that's a big one that I look at. And of course, margins, operating margin over the last 5 years and the trend, and then the trailing 12-month period, free cash flow to sales, ROIC, stuff like that. Another big one I use is the cash conversion cycle. The trend over the last five years, if it's risen or fallen, if it's risen a decent amount, let's say 15% in the past 5 years or so, that's not usually a good sign. You need to find out why that's happened, because that can be a major red flag that the company's not selling their inventory fast enough, that they may have to write down their inventory at some point, which would destroy a lot of balance sheet value. And as a value investor, that's what most of us look for first, is balance sheet strength, a lot of cash compared to little or no debt.
And for the listeners, where do you find the cash conversion cycle?
It's calculated on the Morningstar on their, let's see, their key ratios page under the efficiency
ratios, I think.
Tab. Yeah, okay, I believe so.
It's so funny. I do this so much without even thinking. I don't even remember where I click.
I do the same thing. That's why when you asked me, I was like, I had to think about it. it's at this point, I've done it so much. You said, it's just click, 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 try to get through things as fast as possible. So
yeah, it's like picking weeds.
Yeah, exactly.
And eventually you find like a nice flower or something.
Exactly. Maybe one day you'll find some treasure and it'll be a good company you can buy.
Yes. So do you short stocks at all?
No. Shorting stocks, I mean, I understand the concept, and it's a hedge. And when you find something that is terrible, that you find is terrible, that I logically it makes sense to me. But the scary thing is anything can go wrong with short selling. If you short something, even if it's terrible, and it gets bought out because somebody else wants to buy it out.
Well, you saw that with a David Einhorn last year.
Yeah.
Like, was it, I think, twice.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Well, and another one is Bill Ackman with the Herbalife.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have a different view about that. I don't think he really understood the model as well as he thinks he does, but...
And I would agree. I mean, I haven't studied the situation enough because I don't care about Herbalife.
Yeah. I've had friends who actually have worked for Herbalife
okay.
and who loved it and did okay with it. And they've explained to me the business model, and talking to them, I got a lot more out of it than listening to a 65-page presentation from Bill Ackman.
Well, and that's my problem with Ackman. I read his book, the book about him, The Confidence Game, and it's fascinating, and it's amazing how much work he puts into stuff, and it's admirable. But the problem with what he does is you have to be the smartest person in the room all the time, and even if you are, for example, with the Herbalife case in Bill Ackman, he was right to a degree,
right?
But it's not going to zero. So, and that's what, if you're shorting it, that's pretty much what you're banking on.
Yeah, I think something that I have noticed that's missing with a lot of value investors who think very much like engineers, right?
Yeah.
The world is not always so black and white.
Yeah.
And there's so many new, and Buffett gets this, by the way. There's so many nuances with business models, and there's nuances with people, right? Because at the end of the day, organizations are run by people. And sometimes what you're seeing on a balance sheet or actually, I'm going to scratch that, but sometimes what you're seeing just on paper isn't the full story, and it's missing the context. And I just think that's kind of interesting because when I saw Bill Ackman's presentation on Herbalife, I said, there's nothing inherently not factual about what he's saying.
Yeah.
But there's a context here that I don't think he understands. And that was just my personal view. It's not a personal attack against Ackman. It's just, you know,
and mine isn't either. It's just against the concept of short selling overall.
Right. Yeah.
But that point you made makes perfect sense because I've actually got a blog post I've got planned called The Art of Value Investing, because most people, when they think of value investing, they think it's a science. It's right. not. And that's one of the things when you're learning about value investing, you see all these books that tell you if a company has these ratios and these, and they list like 10 or 20 ratios. If a company has these ratios over a certain amount, buy it no matter what, and you're going to make money. That's right. Not true.
Yes.
Value investing, like with pretty much everything in finance, is more of an art. Once you get over a certain knowledge amount, it's an art more than a science, which is why I don't think people like us will be replaced by robots anytime soon, like a lot of other jobs will.
Right. I think you and you said something, by the way, which is key, which is once you get past a certain knowledge point, because you have to, at the end of the day, you still have to understand how to read a balance sheet and look at a cash flow statement, and you can't just be like, oh, I like this product, I'm going to go buy the stock, which is what, that's the extreme on the other end, which some people do too.
Yeah, the buy only what you know mindset.
Right, yeah. So would you say you have a favorite kind of business that you like to invest in?
Yeah, I like to invest in, like I said before, I'll invest in any company I can understand. But I do have favorite businesses, companies that don't require a lot of operating capital and capital expenditures on a regular basis. Companies that are what are called asset-light businesses. For example, a couple are consulting businesses based on consulting. Businesses that collect royalties.
Have you invested in any consulting businesses or royalty businesses?
Yes, I've actually recommended one to my subscribers, and it's I prefer not to say what it is.
That's okay.
Because it's still it's gone up quite a bit, but it still has room to rise. But it's based on consulting in the energy contracting arena, I guess, is what it's technically in. Royalty businesses, insurance businesses, and those are the kind of businesses that I like, that are my favorites to invest in.
And when you're finding these consulting businesses and royalty businesses, are you also finding those manually as well, like looking just through lists that you download? Or because you talked about OTC and ADR, are you also looking at different indexes and then looking up all the companies in those indexes? What's your process for that, like if it's not OTC or ADR?
Yeah, for example, like Brazil is a perfect example. I've invested there before with Brazil Fast Foods a couple years ago that I recommended, and it shot up a lot and then got bought out by another South American company. But there, Brazil is going through a massive recession that could be heading towards a depression at some point, and they're dealing with a lot of corruption down there. So when I see stuff like that, I do the typical Buffett thing, go where the blood's, what he says, the blood's in the streets, and I look at a country list of all the company, the public companies listed in the United States in Brazil, and then I'll go down that entire list and see if I like any companies in there. Same with insurance companies. I've done this with insurance companies. I download entire list of insurance companies and then go one by one looking through those lists. To put either recommend companies and buy them, or to put them on my watch list if they're overvalued.
And what are you looking for in an insurance company?
I've got four major criteria for insurance companies on top of my other criteria that are for other companies. But the four for insurance companies specifically are: they have to produce consistent underwriting profits. They have to produce consistent below 100% combined ratios, which go hand in hand with each other.
Right.
They have to have produce consistent cumulative redundancies, which is the insurance version of margin of safety. It's a kind of like a savings account, I guess, in a way. It's the cumulative redundancy is if they produce underwriting profits every year, and then it just builds up over time. So the more accumulative redundancies they have, the more margin of safety they have in case of, or when in the insurance business, because it's a matter of when in the insurance business, when something bad and happens, they'll have to pay off a bunch of claims and stuff like that. And then the fourth and last major one with insurance companies is the that management has to be conservative, ultra conservative in everything they do, because like I said, in the insurance business, at some point stuff's going to happen. There's going to be major hurricanes hitting that are going to destroy buildings and stuff like that on Earth. They're going to happen at some point, so you have to have a solid balance sheet and cumulative redundancies built up and statutory capital built up, so you have enough capital so you won't go bankrupt when you have to pay out a ton of claims.
And for the listeners, where do you find the cumulative redundancies?
You can usually there's a big table. I think it's what I remember what it's called off the top of my head. But you can just search Control F when you're reading a financial for an insurance company, and just search cumulative redundancy. If it doesn't pop up, that either means they don't talk about it, which
is a big red flag, by the way. Yeah.
Or they don't have
it. I've seen that before.
Which is another big red flag for insurance companies. So
it's like when a company, I've seen these in a lot of fad companies where they'll only talk about revenue numbers.
Oh. You can tell my reaction to that.
Yeah, exactly. That's the when a fad company has a presentation, not having cumulative redundancies in the insurance businesses is my version of the just revenues in the fad businesses, like the
speaking of, yes, another I have a pet peeve of mine when it comes to insurance companies. Another one that readers or listeners out there who might be wanting to research insurance companies might want to know. for some reason, the combined ratio is the measure of profitability in for insurance companies. Anything below 100% is considered profitable. Anything over 100% is considered unprofitable. So, and that's industry-wide. So,
and 100% is break-even.
Yes, 100% is break-even. Yeah. Sorry.
That's okay.
So you'd expect every insurance company to mention that. I've come across some insurance companies who don't mention the term combined ratio in their entire financials. It drives me insane. That's another
red flag.
A giant red flag.
Yeah. If
an insurance company doesn't mention a combined ratio in their financials, do not buy it.
That's more than a red flag. That's like taking like red tape and wrapping it around the annual report. That's taking a bucket of red paint and just throwing it on the report.
I'm just gonna ignore this giant red elephant over here in the, the corner of the room. I'm not even gonna talk about it because it's so bad.
Oh man. So do you have any deal breakers? Well, we know what your deal breakers are with insurance companies, but in general, do you have any deal breakers of, you know, if it doesn't have this criteria, you're not even gonna consider it?
Yeah, there's one. I have five major criteria for considering investments in companies outside of insurance companies or on top of the insurance ones I just talked about. But the number one is, if I can't trust management, it doesn't matter what the undervaluation or potential opportunity is, I will not invest in the company no matter what. Unless the only time this will be broken is when at my company, if once I build a big enough asset base, I can take over companies and get rid of management if need be. But that's the only time that rule would be broken, because if I can't trust management to do what's right for shareholders, why would I want to buy their company? Right. Why would I trust them to keep doing what they're supposed to do for shareholders if I can't trust them? So that's my number one thing.
Okay. Is there anything else? You said you had five criteria.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
It's okay.
Yes. The other ones are, that's the main one. That's why I want to talk about that first. The other four are, is the company undervalued enough for me, or fairly valued if a great business? Goes back to the value investing concept of margin of safety. This next one is, as well, is there a high likelihood I'm going to lose money no matter what the upside undervaluation is? Value investors worry about risk more than anything, and keeping capital, retaining capital more than gaining capital. Do I already own a better business? If I already own something better, why would I buy something worse just to put another stock in the portfolio? And the last one is, will I be happy owning this investment for decades if necessary? That one just keeps you focused on the long term.
Would you say the exception to that, though, is the net current asset value?
Yes. Stuff? Okay. Yes. Good point. Yes. And special situations as well.
Right.
Those are shorter term most of the time. But yes, and that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. The NCAV ones, yes, are an exception to those rules. I only have two or three of those in my portfolio right now, and their percentage, I think the percentage on each, taking out the portfolios I manage, are 2.5% each. So 5 to 7.5% total of the portfolio, and the Buffett type of good quality companies, I've invested 30%+ in an individual company at one point before.
What's been your largest holding ever?
In terms of percentage?
Yeah.
I think that was, well, at one point I was down to two in the portfolio as I managed. This was a couple of years ago. I was in 80% cash and only owned two stocks or two companies after a few got sold or got bought out and got sold. So I think the highest ever individual company was either 30 or 40%.
Do you mind telling me what it was?
I think it might have been Brazil Fast Food Company.
Okay. What was the situation around that? I'm just to kind of get a real life example of how you think.
Yeah. They were actually another value blogger who I've talked with quite a bit, Red, from the Red Corner blog. Great blog, by the way. Highly recommend going to read his stuff. He got a hold of me and recommended that I take a look at the company. He said it's something I seem like I would like. So I took a look at it. And at that point, I was doing a series on fast food companies. I'd done Jack in the Box, Wendy's. And this was my third one, my fast food company, Brazil Fast Foods. It ran a burger and hot dog joint in Brazil. They had a great balance sheet, a lot of cash, little no debt. Produced very good margins for the fast food industry, because the fast food industry, I'm not sure if you ever looked at it, Eric, generally doesn't, the margins aren't that great.
Mm-hmm.
Produced very good margins for the fast food industry. I think the ROIC was north of 15% at the time, which is very good. The situation there was, it was massively undervalued. I think if I remember right, I had it undervalued by a factor of, I think it was at least a double to my minimum valuation, if I remember right. So there's a gigantic margin of safety there as well.
How are you valuing the company?
For a company like that, I would do it based on operating margin and its assets, and NOLs if a company has any. I add those into the value as well after discounting them. But I just take a multiple of the operating margin, the trailing 12-month operating margin. If it's been stable, if it's not been stable, then I take it from the lower amount, whatever the like if they've had a big spike in sales and profitability in the last year, I'll take the 5-year average. But then I'll multiply that by 8 or 5, 8 or 11 to get just a multiple valuation, and then add cash and subtract debt from that, and then the asset valuation, asset reproduction valuation, typical value investing valuation,
right.
Just focused on the balance sheet there.
Was it trading below replacement value on the balance sheet?
I don't think so, but I think it was close. I think it was selling just above, if I remember right, just above its asset reproduction value.
Which, by the way, is pretty amazing for a company like that.
Yeah, and like I said, the margins were great, little, no cash. The only problem, there was, and it had competitive advantages as well. It had exclusive agreements with Coca-Cola to distribute its Coke and its other products in its restaurants in Brazil at the time. So it had competitive advantage as well, but there were some things that some people, most investors don't like. It was, I think, 70 or 75% family owned.
Okay.
Which most value investors, even value investors, don't like.
I think that can go both ways, by the way.
Yeah. My big thing is, it goes back to if you can trust management.
Right.
That's
in the opposite, where you can trust the management, and now it's a really good thing the family owns it, because they have a real incentive.
And that was my point in the articles I wrote about it, is these guys are doing a great job. Why wouldn't I trust them, even though they own 70 to 75% of the company and can do whatever they want? As an outside investor, I trust that they're going to try to do what's best for all shareholders, because they'll make money along with us. And another thing was that it's in Brazil. Again, goes back to the home base bias that a lot of people don't like. So, investing in foreign companies.
Have you ever invested in Africa?
No, but I have several companies on my watch list that are in Africa.
And did you just find them through the ADR, the OTC list?
Yes. I think they're all in South Africa, if I remember right.
Okay. I'm excited for the day when I interview someone who's like, yeah, I have investments in Chad, or, you know, or some obscure African country. I would love to hear about that one day.
Well, I've got a couple in Eastern Europe, but they're pretty small, so I wouldn't be able to talk about them right now.
Okay.
But maybe off the air we can talk about it, but... Eastern Europe is a place where I was finding some value. Western Europe. I got a couple Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand. I'll look anywhere in the world as long as, like I said, as long as I can trust that the government won't seize the company.
Well, I think the fear in Eastern Europe is that, you know, people in Eastern Europe are terrified of Putin.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the risks in the, one of the Eastern European countries or companies I'm invested in. It's owned. And I think technically the parent company is, if I remember right, in the United States, but operations and everything are in Eastern Europe and Germany.
Right, so the fear could be that Putin comes into that country and nationalizes the asset, and you're wiped out.
But then again, if they go into that far in Eastern Europe, there would be World War III going on.
So. Right, so we have other problems to worry about.
Yeah. Yeah, we'd have bigger problems to worry about.
What would you say are three books that you would recommend to aspiring investors, and why?
The first is, and this gets thrown around by pretty much every value investor, is the Buffett, or not the Buffett, partnership letters. Those are great too, by the way.
Yes.
But the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder letters. The amount of information, he's very candid, which if you've ever looked at him, you know, but is rare for big-time investors to be as candid as he is in the letters. He talks about everything, his thought processes on why he bought a certain company, why he didn't buy a certain company, the managers of the company, why they're doing great, everything. If you want to learn value investing, finance, management, psychology, pretty much anything, you need to read that.
If you want to learn anything, you just have to read it.
Yeah. And I've heard many people say it's better than an MBA, getting an MBA college about finance, learning about finance. The other two are not investment related, but they're more of having the proper mindset. And
so like framework related.
Yeah, and habits, which are a big thing of value investing as well. Mindset by Dr. Carol Dweck.
Okay.
And The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg. Phenomenal books about how to – I actually found mindset by reading an SI.com, SportsIllustrated.com article about Eric Spoelstra a couple of years – this is probably 2 or 3 years ago when the Miami Heat were winning those championships with mm-hmm. LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh. And he was considered a great coach and whatever, an up-and-coming coach. And he said he recommended that book. He reads that book at least once a year just to make sure he's in the proper mindset to continue learning and continue improving as a coach so he can continue improving his teams and winning championships and all that. It's awesome, amazing book. It even tells you if you have a listed in the growth mindset and fixed mindset. And most people are in the fixed mindset where they think they can't improve at anything. Their IQ is fixed. They can't, if they don't know a skill, they can't learn it. If they fail, they give up. She even talks about how to get out of that mindset and into what she calls a growth mindset, which is what most value investors either have or need to have.
Right.
About learning all the time, and you can learn whatever skill you want as long as you put enough time and practice and get enough feedback on it. So it's an amazing book. I'd recommend. I think that book should be taught in schools. That's how important I think that book is. High schools, colleges, universities, everything. So I think that's a big problem. I don't know if you agree with this or not, Eric. You see this more as more than I do, I'm sure, but the fixed mindset is often labeled as a victimhood mindset. It's just, I think that's a lot of people's problems, is that they don't think they can do anything, so they don't even try.
You're talking to someone who has about 9 years of background doing very heavy personal development work, so this could be a whole podcast in and of itself.
Okay. Yeah. I haven't
read either, but
okay. Highly recommend them.
I'm going to read them now. Yes. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I was just going to finish talking about The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg. Another thing about value investing is you need to constantly learn, and you have to push yourself to constantly learn, because there's always more to learn. There's always another company to research. And value investing is a solitary endeavor most of the time. So you have to be self-motivated. And the power of habit teaches you how habits are formed, how to break bad habits, and why they're so hard to break. How to get over the hump of breaking them and turn bad habits into good habits. And for example, one of the things I learned from the book is I used to hate reading. As a kid, I hated doing it. I was more interested in playing sports and hanging out with friends and chasing girls than reading. But as a value investor, you have to read all the time to learn new things and improve and whatever. But now I'm to the point after reading that book and some of the other books that I've read that I read nonstop now. That's what I do more than anything, more than even evaluating companies. Well, I read their financials and whatever, but is that I read and it doesn't even feel like work anymore. I enjoy it because it's become such a habit now that if I don't do it, I feel like I should be doing it. It's just crazy, the psychology of how habits are formed. And I highly recommend that book as well for anybody who wants to learn any skill. Both of these, mindset and the power of habit, I recommend to anybody wanting to learn any skill.
Interesting. And what about for blogs? Do you have two or three blogs that you could recommend in the investing space?
Honestly, they're not necessarily...
Or websites or web resources or anything like that.
The first one, I try not to, and I used to read more blogs, more value investing blogs, and I don't purposely read too many anymore because I don't want to be biased mm-hmm. either for or against any stock they talk about. So anytime I see something like that, a stock write-up or whatever, I try to stay away from it just in case I come across it years later and want to have my own mindset. Not biased in any way against that, but highly recommend the Fundu Professor blog by Sanjay Bakshi.
Okay, how do you spell that?
Fundoo.
Professor.
Professor.
Okay.
That's a phenomenal blog. He teaches everything from Charlie Munger, mental models, Circle of Competence, Buffett, Moats, Float, Investment Floats, everything about that psychology, anything on there that you want to learn about investing, all the important things, behavioral finance, stuff like that. Let's see here. Sorry, I had to look at my list.
That's okay.
Another one is, that's a great read is the Safal Niveshek blog, SafalNiveshek.
You knew I was going to ask you to spell that, right?
Oh, yeah. And I'm not even sure that's how it's pronounced either. So if that's not, I'm sorry to...
to him.
To him, yes. but that's another one that teaches a... amazing mindsets and everything value investing related. Another one is the Baca de Soyo.
You like these names that are impossible oh, yeah. to pronounce.
Bakedesuyo blog has a ton of great book recommendations on there. And that's more of a general knowledge site, leadership, management, not necessarily a finance site, but it's behavioral finance, stuff like that. It's more of a general knowledge. Like I'm a big believer in Charlie Munger's mental models, that the more you know about a wide range of important topics like behavioral finance, behavioral psychology, stuff like that, the more you'll be a better thinker and a better investment analyst as well. So I'm a little bit different when it comes to value investors. I have a wide range of interests. So
yeah, I'm the same way, by the way. And that yeah. principle of having a background in different things can be applied to more than just investing.
Yeah, I agree.
If yeah. you're a doctor, physician, then I'm sure there's things that knowing other than medical stuff that would help you in that practice. I mean, it could go for anything. Yeah. A lot of principles amongst different fields which look unrelated actually end up being incredibly related across the board.
Exactly. One example I have off the top of my head is something Charlie Munger says quite a bit. An example he gives quite a bit about the importance of mental models is the concept in engineering of redundancy. It's the same exact thing as in the value investment world as margin of safety. So there's a lot of stuff like that that goes hand in hand with what we do. So
yeah. Interesting. Well, anything else? Do you have a website or a way for people to contact you if they want to learn more about what you do or possibly invest?
Yeah. My blog is valueinvestingjourney.com. Spelled just how it sounds. I've written a full-length value investment education book titled How to Value Invest, teaching everything from valuations to the technical aspects of some of the ratios.
And where can people read that book?
They can either go to the blog or on Amazon, search it on Amazon. Okay. To find it. And I'm actually working on a second edition of that that I plan to release at some point after I raise the money for Rivera Holdings. And if people are interested in possibly investing or learning more about my company, Rivera Holdings, you can go to my blog as well, and I will be soon posting links and information for potential investors on my blog. So,
cool. Well, anything else you want to share before we wrap this up?
I don't think so, other than I appreciate the time talking with you, Eric.
Yeah, man. Likewise. Well, have a good day, and thanks for being on the show.
All right. You too, buddy.
All right. Thanks, man. Have a good day.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.